Welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts focus on various current topics in MRI. We invite you to ask questions via the website and even suggest topics for future MRI Cast. The opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect standards in clinical practices, nor should they be considered as medical advice. Well, hello, I'm Bill Faulkner, and welcome to this MRI Cast. This is number 3 in a series of 7 MRI casts on the topic of gadolinium-based contrast agents. We're going to be peeling back the gadolinium contrast agents, taking a little deeper look. This series is sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Brocco Diagnostics, and we certainly appreciate their support. Today's MRI cast topic is contrast-enhanced MRA, and with me is Dr. Howard Raleigh and Dr. Paul Finn. Welcome, gentlemen. And Howard, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bill, and welcome back, Paul Finn. It's great to hear your voice again.
Thank you, Howard. Thank you, Bill.
Well, Dr. Finn is in Los Angeles, but I'd like to ask Paul to tell us a little bit about himself, you know, what you've been up to lately in life.
Okay, Bill. Well, I think like most people, I've been trying to avoid COVID for the past year or so, and thank goodness that's been successful so far. But I've been in Los Angeles at UCLA for the past, almost 20 years now.
Wow.
And what I do mainly is I focus on cardiovascular imaging with MRI and CT. In the past, I've had a lot of experience with contrast agents and MR angiography and cardiac imaging. And our practice is pretty busy. And as I say, we do MRI and CT of heart and blood vessels in adults and children. In recent years, my research focus has been on congenital heart disease to some extent in adults and children, and also the use of ferromoxytol or ultra small superparamagnetic iron oxide particles for MR angiography and for vascular imaging, and that's been kind of fun.
Well, it sounds like you've not really had a whole lot to do lately, and it looks, or at least we've asked for the right person to come on and talk with us about this. So let's get things rolling and start with what would you say, and to both of you gentlemen, what would you say would be an advantage or some of the advantages of contrast-enhanced MRA versus non-contrast techniques?
I'll maybe start out then, seeing as how Howard is probably, slipping off the chair for a while.
He naps. He naps periodically.
What'd you say?
And actually, I'd be interested very much to hear what Howard says, because I think things are a bit different in the brain and for neural applications than in the body. But I think in the body, non-contrast techniques have relatively limited applications. Way back, it used to be all we had, but we've been using contrast agents now for about 25 years, and it's made a huge difference. Non-contrast MRA, I think, is still powerful for lower extremity arteries, and a lot of the techniques that Dr. Edelman and his group have developed in Chicago with the KISS technique, I think, are quite powerful for non-contrast MRA in patients who are appropriate for that, who maybe have severe renal failure or other issues with contrast allergies. Other than that, in the body, we use non-contrast techniques in a pretty limited way. Almost all of the MR angiography that we do in the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, and also in the extremities, tends to be with contrast. The advantages of using contrast are typically it's faster than non-contrast techniques. We can usually get everything we're looking at in the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, the whole field of view, within a relatively comfortable breath hold. That's usually not the case with non-contrast techniques. And then the resolution typically is better with contrast agents, because we can go to, you know, pretty high resolution nowadays with 3D imaging. Again, I'd be interested to hear what Howard has to say about the neuro side of things.
Oh, sure. You know, neuro can be a lot easier in some ways because we don't move as much and we've got all those vessels very close to the heart. So we can, we don't have to wait a long time for contrast to arrive or spins to arrive. So we have very good options with both time of flight MRA and phase contrast. You know, the advantages of the non-contrast are several, and we're able to sort of dial in velocities either empirically or by selecting a velocity encoding in centimeters per second. We then don't have venous contamination that we would in sort of a static post-contrast situation. But, you know, there are a lot of uses, and we do use contrast a great deal for neuro MRA and MR venography. Because we can get better, you know, when you have T1 shortening in that contrast-enhanced scan, you get more distal vessels, smaller vessels. You can trade off, as Paul just mentioned, and do things faster, especially with, say, hypersense or other compressed sensing techniques. And you have the ability to do dynamic imaging with things like tricks and twist and treat and whatever the latest are. So that you can tease out the arteriovenous separation and, you know, avoid venous contamination that way. So I think in the end, it's good to have all of these tools in your toolbox for different situations. But for a standard screening exam, a circle of Willis or carotid bifurcation, you can do a perfectly good job typically using a time of flight or phase contrast technique.
One of the things that I had brought to mind when I was listening to y'all talk, some years ago, I heard a doctor do a presentation on contrast enhanced angiography, and he referred to it as flow arrested imaging. And in, you know, teaching basic MR physics, when I do one of those courses, you know, I usually make the statement of something like, you know, non-contrast techniques really do rely on flow. And some cases you can have really bad flow scenarios. For example, talking about neuro, one that comes to mind is like a giant aneurysm, where you really don't have good flow there. It just kind of, you know, for time of flight, there's really nothing to image hardly. And so the doctor that was doing this talk's point was, when you bolus gadolinium, you essentially eliminate all those flow artifacts that you see on time of flight, phase contrast, those flow-based techniques. And would you say that, would you guys both agree with that, that that's kind of a good general way to look at it, what you're doing when you give the gadolinium, as opposed to doing just a non-contrast?
I think that's a good way to think about it. It is, to some extent, kind of independent of flow to that extent. As you pointed out, for time of flight techniques and most non-contrast techniques, we take advantage of the fact that the blood is flowing, you know, to generate signal differences between the blood vessels and the stationary tissues. And if the flow velocity is very low, then that can be more of a problem, particularly for 3D techniques. So yes, contrast MRA tends to take away a lot of the dependence certainly on high flow velocities. However, it is mostly dependent on flow in one way, in that the contrast agent has to get, you know, to the vessels that we're concerned with.
Yeah, little small point there. I guess you do have to.
Well, yes, it's important, but it's something we can completely plan on, because it just emphasizes the importance of timing.
That's the key thing, I think. Don't you agree, Paul, that really there are two phases you can look at or think of when you're using contrast-enhanced MRA. There's the bolus itself, the first pass or first and second pass maybe, where you're actually using the gadolinium as a proxy for blood flow, and you can see differences in arrival times and the timeliness of filling and compare it to other vessels, say in the head and neck. Are the carotids and the verts filling at the same time if you're using, say, a Trix type sequence? But then beyond the first minute or so, you're looking at the blood starting out with a T1 of, I don't know, 12 or 1400 milliseconds, dropping into the few hundred milliseconds. And from that point forward, you've got intravascular signal that's much greater than baseline for virtually any of these techniques that we're using. So it's both the dynamic phase, if you capture it, and it's the more static phase that's good for at least several or many minutes that lets you fill out those smaller, more distal vessels.
That's exactly right, Howard. And the time-resolved MRA is something that has really become ingrained, you know, in the whole practice of contrast MR angiography now, both in neuro, as you point out, Howard, and also for body imaging, for, you know, chest and abdomen and lower extremities. So basically, we inject maybe a small bolus of contrast and then look to see the inflow into various vascular territories, and that can give us a lot of information about relative, you know, time of enhancement or blood flow, or how quickly the blood gets to particular vascular territories or organs. And it's also a great way to time the, you know, main high resolution acquisition, because we can use the information that we get from these time resolved timing runs to tell us how long it will take for a larger bolus of contrast to get to the target vessels. And that's something that we've been doing routinely for decades now. It's basically using these, you know, time-resolved images or timing runs to give us the perfusion-type information, but also importantly to tell us when to acquire the main high-resolution acquisition for the MRA.
When we're talking about time-resolved techniques, one of the things that I've always felt was a great benefit of these techniques is that the fact that you do need less gadolinium for these type of techniques, because the actual acquisition, frame, if you will, the segment that you're filling in K-space is actually just only a few seconds. And so what I've learned is that as you reduce the acquisition time, you really need less gadolinium.
You know, that's exactly right, Bill. And it gives not only some flexibility for the MRA, but it makes way for things like a split dose protocol. A good example is if we're doing some of our stroke protocols, we may want a TRIX acquisition of the neck and the major vessels of the arch. And we can easily do that in an adult with, say, 12 ml, which would be about a 60% dose by weight for most people, and then save the other 8 ml to do a perfusion scan. And the ACR reminds us that, you know, we should use the lowest dose necessary for the information you're trying to get. And by splitting that, we get plenty of signal for both types of exams. And then we've given a full weight adjusted dose, particularly for using high reflectivity contrast, so that we can use that same contrast that's now circulating to get our post contrast parenchymal images. Or we could do a more peripheral runoff if we've got, you know, that full dose in. So we really like the ability to give a fractional dose if we want to do two tricks or twists or whatever, or a tricks and a perfusion in the same setting. And it works really quite beautifully if you get your timing and timing of the center K-space acquisition with the peak of the bolus.
Well, speaking of the relaxivity, y'all's thoughts on relaxivity as it relates to, and I've heard this mentioned, I think Paul was speaking of it, and Howard, I think you did too, actually. When you finish with, you know, a standard MRA acquisition, if you have, and I think studies have shown this, that you're using the high relaxivity agent, for example, Multihance, that it doesn't necessarily stay in the bloodstream longer, it just stays brighter longer. And that does give you the opportunity to acquire some very high spatial resolution images. I know I've seen publications on it in the legs, but I've also seen it in the chest as well. Any thoughts or experience with that, with on the steady state, the more high res steady state type?
Yes, that's absolutely true. Once we inject, a bolus of the contrast agent initially, as Howard was mentioning, it comes around, in relatively high concentration in the arteries. And then after a minute or so, it distributes fairly uniformly throughout the, all of the vascular space, all of the arteries, all of the veins. And then it also starts to leak out into the interstitial space, the spaces between the blood vessels and the cells, fairly quickly with most agents. As it relates to relaxivity, that's a very good point. If we're using an agent with a high relaxivity, that means we get a higher effect for a given dose with a higher relaxivity agent than we do with a standard or lower relaxivity agent. And as you mentioned, that is the case with, for example, multihands, because it tends to bind to plasma proteins more than the other extracellular contrast agents. And for that reason, it tends to have a higher relaxivity, and that persists for longer, such that you do have a better chance of getting good quality images in the later phase, after a minute or two. And that's been shown in publications. In the past, this used to be a strong advantage of an agent called Ablivar, or the generic term for that was gadofosfazet, a bit of a mouthful. But Ablivar was a blood pool agent, which is also gadolinium-based, and it used to bind to proteins, quite strongly, and had a very high relaxivity, about, maybe 4 times what the other extracellular agents have. And it stayed in the bloodstream for longer, such that you could get these, high resolution delayed images in the steady state. Ablivar was removed from the market in, I believe it was 2015, about 5 years ago. So it's no longer available. But we, in fact, have been using an iron-based agent, ferumoxytol or ferraheme, which has a similar effect, but an even more powerful effect. So with ferumoxytol, you can basically take images up to hours after you inject it. So it's a technologist's dream for many applications in the, chest, abdomen, and pelvis. But yeah, high resolution steady state imaging is something that you can do, better with high relaxivity agents than with the standard agents.
And Bill, there have been a bunch of studies, both in blood vessels and in the brain parenchyma in particular, showing essentially, to summarize quickly, that a half dose of gadobenate or multihance gives you the same sort of enhancement characteristics of a full dose of most of the traditional agents. And so, that has other implications besides just being able to, say, split your dose and use a lower dose for MRA. It also means that, for example, in our shop, we decided long ago to cap adults at 20 mLs because if we're using multihance and you look at how that would compare to a full dose of multihance comparing to any other agent, any patient up to 100 kilos or 200 kilos, I should say 440 pounds, you can expect to get at least as good of enhancement as if you'd been giving a full dose of one of the traditional agents, weight adjusted. So it really has a lot of implications and gives you a lot of flexibility. And the other end of the scale with babies, newborns, multihance is approved for fractional doses like half, three quarters, so that if you don't need it, you can give a smaller dose, and that's on label.
When we're talking about dose, and I want to come back to the ferumoxytol because I'm seeing a lot more of that. We get a lot more questions about that in some of the classes that we're doing. So I want to definitely come back to that and get a lot more information and education on my part about that. But let's go back to talking about the use of gadolinium-based contrast agents, whether we're talking about standard relaxivity or higher relaxivity. And I want to get your guys' thoughts on calculating the volume to be delivered. You know, usually when we're talking about gadolinium and in brain and spine imaging, you know, it's weight-based dosing. And as Howard pointed out, you know, capping it off at 20, but we go by weight-based dosing. When we're doing contrast-enhanced MRA, that's typically not the case, that the dose or the volume that we're going to be administering depends on other factors rather than just body weight. So again, I would like both of y'all's thoughts on what you think, how one should approach the dose and or volume to be delivered.
That's a very good question, Bill. You know, our approach to dosing with contrast MRA has been, you know, always to some extent weight-based, not maybe as precisely as for MRI. But as you're getting to, the volume that you inject is significant for contrast MRA, whereas it may not be significant for, you know, standard non-dynamic MRI of the brain or of the musculoskeletal system or whatever. So what I always think about is the relationship between how long it's going to take to acquire the data. Let's say it's a breath hold, and let's say the breath hold is about 20 seconds. Then, you know, what I like to do is to have relatively even concentration of contrast agent in the bloodstream of interest, and usually that will be the arteries, during that 20-second period. The way to try to get there is to somehow try to match the duration of your contrast infusion to the duration of the image acquisition. So, you know, when we inject a bolus of gadolinium, let's say we inject it in 2 seconds, right? Let's say a test injection. And let's say we inject at 2 cc's per second and we follow it through with 20 cc's of saline. Then when that gets around to the arteries, it will show a peak and that will last, you know, a few more than the 2 seconds that we inject it. But it will have a fairly well-defined peak that may last for 5 or 6 seconds or so before it tends to tail off. Then when we infuse, let's say, 30 cc's at 2 cc's per second, that would take 15 seconds. That will now sort of spread that peak over probably about 20 seconds. And that's what we always try to do, is to match that window to the time when we're doing the breath hold or acquiring the data. And we do that firstly by giving a test injection that will, as I mentioned, tell us how long it will take for the bolus to start arriving. And then we use that to time the injection. From a volume perspective, what that means is, you know, you want to inject at a certain rate such that it will take you maybe 15 seconds to inject your dose. And that will, you know, spread out over about a 20-second peak, for want of a better term, once it gets to the arteries. The easiest way I have found to make sure that happens is maybe always to inject 30 cc's. Now, you can do that, you know, in two ways. You can either inject 30 cc's of undiluted contrast, but that's going to be a high dose, you know, routinely, and maybe a very high dose for some patients. Or you can, you know, estimate what dose you would want to give on a weight basis initially, and then just use that much. Let's say it's 14 cc's. Then you might make it up to 30 cc's just by diluting with saline, such that now you have 30 cc's of dilute contrast, but you eject that at 2 cc's per second, and that will spread your bolus again over the 20 seconds that you want. What that means is that, you know, you need to dilute the contrast, but that's completely flexible. You can always do that.
So that's an interesting way to look at it, and I've never thought of it that way. So rather than change the rate of the injection, you know, in terms of cc's per second to get it in that window that you want, you basically increase the volume that you're delivering in the contrast side of the syringe, if you will, so that you get that, you know, spread out over that time period. That's a really good way to, way to look at it.
So for, you know, for a typical adult then, no matter what dose of gadolinium you're using, you're always, let's say, injecting 30 cc's at 2 cc's per second. So it's a simpler process, you know, for technologists to remember. You don't have to change your injection rates ever. And, you always flush this through with about 20 cc's of saline at the same rate. But that's always the same, and that will always give you that sort of 20-second, typically, peak of contrast when it gets there. And particularly with, you know, with high relaxivity agents, as Howard mentioned, you can sort of get by with lower doses. And what this does is it spreads the concentration pretty evenly over the time when you're acquiring the data, the case-based data. And again, what you'll hear time and time again, and it's true, is that the data at the center of case-based, you know, are the most important. So you want to make absolutely sure that your contrast bolus and your blood concentration is good during that phase at least. But it's not all that matters. So if you miss the center of case space, it's good night. you're not going to get a good study. But if you get it and you also get the more peripheral parts of case space, that will give you a nice high-resolution image. So they're all important, but the center of case space is the most important.
You know, and we have some similar thoughts, but because we're using slightly different techniques, we think of it just a little bit differently. So we also like the idea, in adults at least, of a fixed dose and volume and timing for things like our tricks, angio, and for our perfusions, those first pass. And because we're using fractional doses, we're not going to be overdosing any adult. So, for example, I mentioned earlier the split would be something like 12 mLs for a perfusion, for example, and 8 mL for tricks. And actually, you could do it in either direction there. And what we do is we build the protocol to have extra phases in case, say, you got somebody with low cardiac output and they're going to arrive late. You know, these typical dynamic sequences run about a minute and 20 seconds maybe. And, you know, you better hope that the bolus gets there by a minute and 10 seconds or they're in trouble.
Well, maybe you've now diagnosed the problem.
Exactly. So we make it foolproof by basically getting some extra phases on our time-resolved MRAs and our perfusions so that we know we're going to get the bolus, including enough to do tracer kinetic modeling if we need to. And, you know, before that, you know, the overall dose, most of these are proved at 0.1 millimole per kilo in terms of the calculations. And I was never very good at sums or intus or takeaways. So we built a free calculator called GadCalc that you can find on the University of Wisconsin-Madison Contrast Corner, or you can just go to the App Store and download it for free. And it has all the currently used agents and the doses and things like Gadivis that are double concentration. It automatically calculates that out for you for a 0.1 millimole per kilo. As mentioned earlier, though, really, I think for most people using a high relaxivity contrast agent, you don't need more than 20 mLs. You're really dealing more of a lean body mass kind of situation. And in Wisconsin, we rarely see that, myself included. There's a lot of fat that doesn't really take up much gadolinium. So it's not a straight curve all the way up, you know, to the dozens of cc's beyond 20. So we just cap everybody at 20.
Yeah, they're very good points. Howard. And yes, the issue you bring up, which we hadn't mentioned before, is concentration of the agent. And you know, there's one agent, clearly Gadivist, which is now sold in a higher concentration than the other agents. Gadivist is one molar, which means a given volume of the agent contains twice as much gadolinium as the same volume of, let's say, Multihance or Prohance or Dotarim. So that means you do have to make these adjustments for MRA, because you'll typically be injecting a smaller volume if you use the undiluted agent. And if you dilute it, then you should dilute it by twice as much as you would dilute, let's say, Magnavist or Prohance or Multihance.
So when this is, and I think this came up in a previous podcast we did when we were talking about pediatrics. I think Kristen raised the question, especially for very, very small children. If you're, using standard agents, you're really giving very little. And then if you're in terms of volume, and then if you're using the one molar agent, Gadivist, you're even giving less. And so this idea of, we say diluting, but it's still the same amount of GAD, so you're really not diluting it. I don't know what there's a better word for it, but basically you're raising the volume, and that can be very important. Would you not agree on smaller patients?
I couldn't agree more. And sometimes, if some of the patients that I end up studying, they may weigh 2 or 3 kilograms, and I may be using something like a half ml of agent. Now, you realistically, when you're drawing up contrast agents, if your total dose is going to be that low, and there I'm referring, I guess, specifically to ferumoxetol, because the dose is very low. But for any agent, if you're trying to draw up a very small volume, then if you get that wrong, by a half cc or something, proportionately, it's a big difference, a big percentage error. So absolutely, the way to minimize that is to dilute the agent initially. And if you dilute it, let's say, by a factor of 5, if you draw up 5 cc's of the contrast agent, and let's say another 15 cc's of saline, such that now it's quarter strength, basically, then you have much more, margin for error as you draw up the volume. And I think that's important for very small children.
I like the concept. And I think both of you stated is like, when you come up with your techniques and your protocols, you're really maintaining a particular volume. Now, the amount of GAD that'll be in, so we're going to give 30 cc's to your example. How much of that 30 cc's is gadolinium really then depends on the dose that you're wanting to give the patient, correct? Is that a good way to pare it back?
That depends on the size of the patient.
That's very good. Very good point. I've never really thought of it that way. With regard to rate, I know you mentioned 2 cc's a second. I had heard, and maybe this is due to older technologies or something, but I was always taught that going too high in a rate of injection can predispose you to certain artifacts, edge-type artifacts, because as you go higher in the rate, then the change in contrast, as you're going through the middle of K-space, the change in contrast is really dramatic, and this could result in some artifacts. Thoughts on that? Again, I've always been somewhere between the 1.5 to 2 mL rate kind of a guy. Thoughts on the actual injection rate? Or is it more dependent, really, going back to what we said, on the technique that you're doing nowadays?
Yes, and I don't want to monopolize this part of the conversation. I'll defer.
Well, that's why we had you on here, so that you could monopolize.
We want you to pass go and collect $200.
Yes, this is a kind of a very interesting and important point. And again, it's more related to the, you know, the concentration of the agent in the vessel at the time, Bill. So as an example, if we use regular undiluted contrast and we inject it, let's say at 2 cc's per second, we used to do this all the time years ago. What you might often find is that, let's say you're doing an MR angiogram of the chest, you'd often find that, you know, you might get very nice vascular images of the pulmonary arteries and the aorta, but you might lose your signal up around the subclavian artery and vein on the side that you injected. And what's happening there is, you know, as you inject fairly rapidly, let's say with a high concentration of the gadolinium, then locally just there, the concentration gets pretty high and it doesn't necessarily wash out, you know, very quickly in some patients. So when you have a high concentration of gadolinium, let's say in a vein, then it has a strong effect, not just on the T1, but on the T2. So it drops the T2 and that drops your signal. And that sort of effect spreads out locally such that it takes out not just the vein, but the artery beside it. And the way to not do this, again, is to dilute the agent, and then you can inject at the usual rate, and your concentration locally will never get above, you know, whatever your dilution factor is relative to the undiluted contrast. It's less common, I think, to see this sort of effect once the agent gets around to the arteries, because it's got to go through the heart and the lungs and so forth. And you would need to inject, I think, a large amount at a very high rate to see that effect. But it's something you definitely can see up around the, you know, the subclavian artery and vein.
And sometimes, you know, crossing over, if you're injecting from the left, you'll see this sort of band-like signal drop out in one or more of the great vessels. And that's just that T2 star effect from the metal washing by in high concentration and killing the signal in the bystander arteries. And that can, you have to recognize that, or you can overcall stenosis, for example.
I always thought it was a good idea, like for an arch carotid, at least in the facilities when I had a real job, I would always kind of direct everybody, okay, so the thing to do here is always run a second pass. I mean, this is just a standard, this was before the days of time resolved. So we'd do our standard, you know, elliptical type filling of K-space, you know, that lasts 40, 50 seconds. But I would always run a second pass, because in the event you did have pooling in the subclavian vein, by the second pass, that would be gone for the most part. And that might keep somebody from overcalling a stenosis in that area.
Yes, that will work in a similar sort of way, Bill. You know, the agent just gets diluted over time as it gets washed out. But again, you can kind of completely avoid this happening in the first place just by, let's say, diluting the contrast by a factor of 2. And in most cases, you know, for single dose contrast nowadays, let's say with a standard agent like Magnivist, I guess, isn't used all that much anymore, or Prohance or Dotarem, you know, you may be using, let's say, about 14 cc's for a typical adult. If you just dilute that in about the same volume of saline, you may be injecting 30 cc's. So it would be diluted by a factor of 2. And typically, if you're injecting at 2 cc's per second, that will typically be enough such that you don't ever see this artifact, you know, in the subclavian vein and artery.
The other just big picture point in terms of injection rates for things like perfusion, because you're doing, you know, tracer kinetic modeling and, you know, deconvolution and so forth, you really want a higher rate in general to make the kinetics work better. So those are usually injected at about 4 cc's a second. But I agree, for the time resolved and other MRA applications, slow works pretty well around, we use 2 mLs per second for our Trix arches, for example.
Well, in reality, with perfusion imaging, you're wanting to take advantage of the T2 star shortening effects. So that's why you need that rate. And in fact, perfusion analysis can really fall apart if you're not injecting at a pretty good clip, correct?
That's exactly right. And just to be clear about it, what you're doing with perfusion is you're looking at metal washing through your brain, and you're capturing that with a T2 star sequence, typically a gradient echo EPI, and you're looking for that signal drop to show you wherever the blood is going, you know, because the contrast is a proxy for blood. In the case of the MRs, we're using some sort of nominally T1 weighting. We're looking for T1 shortening to give you bright signal. So they're the opposite side of this coin of a metal contrast agent, one a T2 star effect and one a T1 effect. So you have to be looking with the right kind of image at the right time to pull out the contrast and information you're looking for.
While we are getting close to the end here, I do want to hear a lot more about the ferroheme, which is a superparamagnetic iron oxide.
Yeah, sure, Bill. It's kind of interesting. Ferroheme, or ferromoxetol as it's known generically, it's sold as ferroheme. That's the trade name. And in fact, it did start out as being aimed at the MRI angiography market as a blood pool agent. That's how it was originally designed. And it's based on iron. It's an iron oxide particle, with very small particle size. but the manufacturers, after some initial clinical trials that were promising, but basically they figured, at the time, gadolinium was coming into favor for MRA, and I think they probably figured it would be too much of a niche market. So they retasked it towards the iron therapy market. So it's actually approved by the FDA for intravenous iron supplementation in iron deficiency anemia, and that's its use. But then in about, I think it was maybe 2012, the UCSF group published a paper showing its use for dialysis fistulas in patients with end-stage renal failure. And this was at a time, when we were completely turned off of gadolinium in renal failure because of NSF. So this looked like a tremendous solution to that. So after that, several of us started to use this agent for diagnostic purposes in patients with renal failure. And it turns out it's pretty amazing. It's got a very high T1 relaxivity, and it also has a high T2 relaxivity. And its T1 relaxivity means that you can inject it and in steady state. And Howard alluded earlier on to what you could do, and you did as well, Bill, about, when agents get around the entire blood pool in steady state, if they have high relaxivity, you can still get high resolution images with good contrast. Ferroheme is just like that. It stays completely within the blood pool. It doesn't leak out at all. And once you inject it, the effect lasts for hours. So basically all of the arteries, all of the veins light up, and you can just go to work. There are no issues necessarily with timing. And usually we use this in steady state, which is perfect, for chest, abdomen, pelvis. If the breath hold doesn't work the first time, do it again. Adjust your parameters. You've lost nothing in terms of where the contrast is. The concentration in the blood is completely stable for hours. And the FDA has sort of warned against injecting it by bolus because of, a risk, small risk it would appear, of allergies. So in most cases, we just use this agent. And again, it's off-label for diagnostic purposes. It's only approved for therapy. But we use it, in steady state for imaging in our practice, chest, abdomen, pelvis. I also use it for lower extremities in appropriate patients. and it's very powerful for complex vascular diseases and congenital heart disease. So, you know, we don't have time, I think, to review everything, but I think it's a very exciting agent. Right now, it's limited by availability, cost, and the fact that it's not approved, you know, formally for MRI. And we need to be, you know, to be careful that patients don't develop allergic reactions. We haven't seen it in our practice, but it's been described in therapy.
I'd add one more use is that it's been used for years and years in pregnant patients who are iron deficient. And based on that, we've developed a protocol for rule out PE in the pregnant patients using ferroheme with MRI rather than giving them contrast or radiation.
Yeah, and that's a fantastic application, Howard.
One of the things that's interesting about that is that I have seen some papers using it in neuroimaging with susceptibility-weighted imaging, because you can see just all kinds of bazillion vessels when this stuff is on board with the susceptibility-weighted imaging. And for that reason, it brings to mind, I've gotten, a few emails over the years, and people will say, you know, they'll get patients and it looks like they've had gadolinium administered, but they haven't given it yet. Turns out these people are actually on ferroheme or they're on some sort of iron therapy. And because of that, if you know, Paul, you said it can last for hours. I mean, it truly can last days. I mean, if you get somebody for a standard MRI and they've had this stuff within the last, 2 or 3 days, it can still look like there's gadolinium on board.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Bill. With ferroheme, you know, the half-life is quoted at about 15 hours in the blood. And in most patients, I think it's that at least. It's kind of dose dependent. So when I say, it stays around for hours, what I mean is you can do MR angiography for several hours without the agent changing its effect hardly at all. But yes, it's detectable sometimes for days. Now, in most cases, after a couple of days for routine imaging, it'll probably have died away quite a bit. But it's eventually taken up by the liver and spleen and bone marrow. And then eventually it's incorporated into, red blood cell synthesis. It's like food. But in the meantime, it can stay around for a while in that sort of format in the liver and spleen and bone marrow. So it could make those organs look, a bit darker on T2 images than they otherwise would. And that's something to be aware of.
For routine, off-label, but routine MRAs, how does the dose that you give someone compare to the therapeutic dose that they would get? Like what's the relationship? I know it's less, obviously.
Yeah, it's usually a fraction, maybe half or less. The therapy dose is basically a gram of iron. And that's usually given in two doses, maybe a few days apart, of a half gram each time. So ferroheme comes in a bottle that contains a half gram. For therapy, patients will usually get one bottle one day and another bottle maybe a few days later for a total gram. For MRI, for a routine adult-sized patient, I will tend to use about a half a bottle. So that would be a quarter of the full therapy dose or about a half of the single time injection dose. But it's likely effective at a half to two-thirds that dose. I haven't gone, overboard about trying to minimize the dose because, to be honest, in most patients, you'd like to give the whole the whole dose because so many of the patients that we examine are renal failure, renal impaired patients who have anemia. So this is a very unique situation where, having completed the diagnostic study, we may then just give the rest of the ferroheme to the patient for therapy, because if we don't do that, we have to throw it out. And it's sort of indicated for them. Sometimes their physicians ask us to do this because they may be having it anyway. So it's interesting and kind of unique.
It is. It is. Howard, anything else to add to that?
Our default dose on that is 3 milligrams per kilo in general. So that's, I think, in the same ballpark as Paul just described.
Yeah, I use routinely 4 milligrams per kilogram, but a lot of people who use it use 3, as Howard has mentioned. Some people use 2. My experience has been that in steady state, it's actually quite good at 2. It's better at 3, and it's better at 4. So, yeah.
Well, great. Howard, before we end this, because we're getting close to the end here, would you say the name of that app again that you mentioned, because apparently you've got it on the app store?
Absolutely. It's called GADCALC. It's all one word, GADCALC. So GADCALC, gadolinium calculator. And that was a brainchild of Scott Reeder and my son, Joe, before he had a real job. But he was already a programmer, so he put that together for us.
I know how that goes. Well, gentlemen, I certainly want to thank you. Paul, it's been great to have you. You'll have to come back and join us again on some other topic sometime.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Bill. It's been terrific chatting with my friend, Howard Rowley, and Bill Faulkner. So I'll be only delighted to join you anytime.
Well, that's great. Howard, thank you again, as always.
Thank you both. I really enjoyed this. Thanks, Paul. Nice talking to you again.
You bet, Howard, you too.
All right, folks. Well, that brings us to the end of this MRI cast. Again, this episode was sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics. Thank you for the support. Again, Howard and Paul, it was great to have you. Thanks for all the useful information. So that's it. We're done. You'll just have to get over it. See you next time.
Thank you, Bill. Bye.
You've been listening to MRI Cast, produced by William Faulkner and Associates and Northwest Imaging Forums.